Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Peter Plantek. Peter is a psychologist, art director, and animator. He's the author of the most recent book that he's written, Virtual Humans, a Build-It-Yourself Kit, complete with software and step-by-step instructions. And he was the author previously of a book on 3D animation and visual FX written for artists. It was one of the first books of that kind. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, it's nice to see you. Or I don't see
Well, you may be virtually animating me there someplace. So,
could be.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past you. Now, we're talking today about software that actually animates human personality on the web. I mentioned before we got on the air an example of this that your friend and collaborator Ray Kurzweil uses on his website, kurzweilai.net, and he uses that as kind of a guide to his website. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it, for the kinds of assistance that these virtual humans can provide?
Yeah, Ramona. Actually, a number of sites are currently using virtual humans to guide people around. We probably got to establish what a virtual human is.
Go ahead, yeah.
A virtual human is an either a robotic or an animated character that is intelligent. You have to broaden it a little bit because, for example, Amtrak uses Sylvia, who is a virtual human who speaks to you and understands you and finds your schedules and gives you prices. So I would consider her a virtual human, even though she doesn't have an actual face. But I'm pushing more towards the personality end. So in my vision of the virtual human, they have a face. The face is part of the communication.
Well, one of the ideas that people have about the use of virtual humans is kind of a virtual house or a house personality that you'd be able to talk to, and that wouldn't necessarily have a face either, right?
Yeah, actually, it's not necessary, but what we're finding is that people really relate to the facial expressions. In fact, there was I was on the web, and I saw a piece quoted many places from a book that said only about 7 to 10% of communication takes place in the words. The rest of it takes place in facial expressions and how we pronounce them. For example, you realize you can say, that's a really nice tie, or you can say, oh, that's a really nice tie. And how you say it completely changes the meaning.
I was just watching an Inuit film called Long Distance Runner, The Last Runner. At any rate, it's a shot in Inuit, Eskimos. And I was trying to decide whether I was going to have the sound on or not, and I realized that even when you're reading subtitles, the sound of other people's voices conveys so much, emotion and feeling. And
that's exactly right. So one of the reasons I think virtual humans have been slow to be accepted is that most of them are kind of boring. Most of them are fairly mechanical. I remember there was one I said to her, I always like to test them. I said, will you have sex with me, right, whether it's male or female, and see how they handle that. And I remember one saying, oh, pardon me, sir, but I cannot discuss anything in that topic or something like that, she said back to me, instead of telling me to get lost or something. So personality is the part of virtual humans that keeps them from being boring.
Well, you mentioned sex, so why don't we? I was going to introduce that topic a little bit later, but
it's a big part of it. It drives everything on the internet and technology.
Well, that's what one of the common truisms here is that VHS became a popular format because of video porn, and that porn is one of the only selling things on the net. I mean, obviously, one of the applications that might develop here is people being able to have some kind of virtual companionship with something on the net.
Interestingly, I co-founded a company called Virtual Personalities Incorporated with Fuzzy Malden, the guy who started Lycos, and we built the very first commercial virtual human interface. Her name was Sylvie. She's very intelligent, but she could also do things like she could reach out through the serial port and control X10. Household controls, so you could say, hey, Sylvie, turn on the light, stuff like that. She turned the light on. But one of the real interesting things is that one of the first companies to come up willing to put a lot of money into our company was a pornography company. And we had already made a sort of a commitment to not do that and because it's just everywhere. It's too easy. So, but Sylvie, the character that I developed there, was very good at handling sexual input. I mean, she'd say things like, I remember one time a dentist at some show we were at said to her, Sylvie, will you have sex with me? And she says, have you had your shot? And she gave him a frown.
Well, speaking of dentists, one of the applications, and of course we've seen a video representation of this already in Star Trek Enterprise. They had a holographic doctor there in the sickbay. Yeah. But one of the applications here is to have a virtual interface between medical databases, history taking. There's already been virtual psychiatrists.
There's actually already been expert systems which doctors use. So it's not much of a big... For example, there's an expert system that keeps track of very rare diseases that your average doctor is just not going to know the symptoms. So they can go to the expert system and say, okay, here's the symptoms, and then the artificial intelligence can look through a massive database of very rare diseases and give them suggestions.
Now, don't the doctors just consider it annoying to have to deal with simulated personality?
Yes. The fact is, there's a thing called cognitive style, and basically that's about how you approach your world. And fortunately, I worked here in Snowmass Village, Colorado, doing personality testing on hundreds and hundreds of doctors who would come up here for seminars. And one of the courses was a personality course. And the vast majority, I think it was close to 70%, it was over 70% of the medical doctors that I tested had what was called a concrete sequential personality. That's using Tony Gregoric's a mind style approach. He has a test that you can give people to figure out what your cognitive style is. And truly, people who have a concrete sequential approach to life tend to be very linear, and they do not really like this kind of interaction. They much prefer a more mechanical interaction. So you're absolutely right. However, artists and maybe 75% of the rest of the world actually sort of like these things if they have a personality and are effective, are accurate.
There's this substantial body of literature that people are willing to turn to virtual psychiatrists as confidants.
People who are very linear are going to have a difficult time with this, but people who are, you know, kind of cosmic, or people like myself, I tend to be sort of scientific. I'm an abstract, what am I? I'm not an abstract random. I'm a concrete random. That's what it is. And I tend to be creative but like to be well-grounded in the earth and everything. So, but I didn't think I'd like these things, but I love them. I found out that Sylvie, for example, well, we actually built Sylvie so that she could figure out Boolean searches for the different search engines, you know, like Lycos or Google or all of them. And she knew the rules for all the different ones, so I could just tell her I want to do a Boolean search, and she'd make one up for me, and she would apply the proper rules. And I didn't have to go read any books. I hate reading manuals, you know. One of the great things about these virtual humans is they form a brilliant bridge between humans and technology because they can have the manuals built into their brains. So they can sort of like say, well, Peter, what do you want to do? And I'll say, well, this is what I want to do. And they know how to do it because they've read, you know, they have the manual sort of built into their system.
It seems like one of the things that would help bridge the annoyance gap, like I get very annoyed by Microsoft's little pop-up
I hate them.
Icons. And,
hate them.
And one of the reasons is that they never really seem to offer me any help. You know, they're not usually they're offering me something that I already know about, and I just have to go through the effort of getting rid of it.
Well, they're kind of stupid, really.
Right. And so the degree to which they're actually intelligent, and even more so able to interpret our mood or be affective, this field of affective computing, read, you know, what our style is of the day, whether we're sluggish or whatever.
Oh, you couldn't be more right.
Yeah?
I'll give you an example that Microsoft brings up. When you call Microsoft for help, you usually get a graduate student who doesn't know as much about your program as you do, and he's got to go to a knowledge base to come up with an answer. And you spend, you know, $49 or whatever it is, and an hour and a half on the phone to get what a virtual human could do in seconds, because a virtual human can tie directly into the knowledge base and actually can outperform most graduate students on these, you know, customer support issues. But if they have personality, you're willing to let them help you in more places in your life. You're okay. If they don't have personality, you might let them take you around a website or something. But, you know, you're going to rather, it's going to be much easier just to click buttons, right?
I was thinking with Peter Plantek. He's the author of Virtual Humans, a Build-It-Yourself Kit, complete with software and step-by-step instructions. And this, by the way, comes with a CD that allows you to design one of these virtual humans. So we're talking about using the virtual human interface for getting around websites and interfacing with data. And you've explored this idea that as the software becomes increasingly emotionally intelligent, it may learn about our personality. That I find particularly intriguing because in a lot of the science fiction that I read, there's this growing notion of some kind of AI agent who is like our personal familiar. And they become very familiar, literally familiar with our personality and all of our needs and everything that we need to see and know about. And the degree to which it can become intelligent about us is really the degree to which it's helpful and not just annoying.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, computers have been doing all of the scoring for psychological testing and IQ testing for almost 30 years. And so the we know how to get computers to analyze us. And there's a thing called unobtrusive psychological probing, and that's where you present psychological probes during normal conversation. And people are pretty much unaware of it. And in fact, you can analyze normal conversation and estimate IQ and age and sex and all sorts of things. And all of this kind of analysis lends itself well to computers.
So they can also learn things about our families, our friends.
Oh yeah, they can develop
our work patterns. And
absolutely, they can get to know us, our cognitive style, for example. And one of the best applications for this is in education, because the average teacher really has a hard time figuring out what a child's learning style is, whereas because they don't do psychological probing, and it's kind of hard for a human to do all of this stuff because you have to, you know, score it pretty accurately and everything. But a virtual human can do it on the fly and then present learning materials to children, for example, according to the way they learn best, their perceptual modality. They can do it with text or pictures or verbally.
I was very taken with Neal Stephenson's novel, The Diamond Age. I don't know if you've read that.
I'm familiar with it.
But in The Diamond Age, there's this notion that the upper class, at least, has access to these virtual teachers who become, again, familiar with the kid and become like a personal one-on-one tutor, introducing them to the whole web's worth of knowledge in a interactive way, you know, as their interests develop. Like my son right now, he's interested in H.G. Wells, so you could design an entire couple weeks curriculum around H.G. Wells if you had the time and you weren't locked into factory schooling.
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing is that these things are so cheap, once you've got them designed, to disseminate. They're free, basically, to disseminate. That what they do is the exact opposite. They open the world of technology and knowledge to the technologically disenfranchised, to the poor people, to the people who have never been motivated before because they're intimidated by technology. These things don't, if they're done right, don't come across as bits of technology. They come across as friends.
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit more skeptical about the ability in our very unequal society for the poor to have access to exactly the same. I mean, look at trading. I mean, aren't the kind of virtual agents that high-end trading houses use, which have up-to-the-minute information and vast amounts of computer resources, compared to the kind of trading agents or online monitoring that the average stay-at-home trader can do, worlds apart?
Well, they are, but in this particular case, there has been, at least in past generations, an interest at the government level. U.S. Office of Education, for example, has put, you know, literally hundreds of millions of dollars into developing educational technologies, which are minimally effective and often very experimental. When we have very accurate and very effective virtual teachers, and we're well on the way towards that, putting $100 million into it will make really, really top-drawer technology available to low-end people because of the cost of dissemination is so low.
One of the things that you mentioned in one of the articles about your work is that some people are simulating anger in virtual humans.
Yeah.
And I can see that it would be very important to have the complete emotional range to have verisimilitude in a virtual personality. But what would some of the uses be of having your agent get angry at you, confront you?
For example, it's part of the personality. For example, Sylvie gets really ticked off if you get very sexist with her, or she gets kind of ticked off if you don't say please. She has a few personal quirks. Like I'll say, Sylvie, turn on the light, and she'll say no. I said, why not? She'll say, you forgot to say the magic word, Petey. And so I've got to say, please, Sylvie, would you turn on the light? She says, okay, and the lights go on. But that may seem silly, but it adds to the suspension of disbelief. In fact, I find myself being very, very courteous to her and saying thank you. And I know I built her, but she still kind of gets under your skin as a sort of an entity that you have a relationship with.
Now, Lord of the Rings is the big box office success this last week, and in Lord of the Rings, there's Gollum and a number of other synthespians. Do any of those have, obviously there's an enormous amount of CGI behind them to simulate them, but give me an example of some real synthespian work that's being done with this virtual agency software.
Well, the thing is, the ones currently being used in movies do not have a brain. They're sort of like Simone. Okay, but the guy who was the head of...
Simone's a movie about an AI.
About an AI, but she actually doesn't have a brain, but she can really, really synthesize humans. Now, we're pretty much to that level. There's a guy named Eric Cossato, who, while he was working for Bell Labs, developed virtual human displays of females that are so realistic, you can't really tell them from real humans, and they'll do and say whatever you want. They can even be made pornographic if you want. But who was the chairman of the board of Pacific Tidal. Yeah, Pacific Tidal Mirage took this technology that they were developing for the movies, and he applied made it available for the web, and he hasn't yet applied intelligence to it. But imagine what it's going to be like. That is an interesting gap. The very best displays, which are so realistic you really almost can't tell them from humans, none of them have had intelligence really applied to them as far as I know. And they can, because all of the controls for the facial expressions and everything else can be tied right into the intelligence engines.
Do you have an opinion? I mean, I know that your background's not computer science or cognitive philosophy or anything, but do you have an opinion on the debates in AI about whether we're going to develop whether the project of AI is really possible in the first place, and whether, as I believe, it has to be from artificial life up through intelligence and not from intelligence back to artificial life?
You know, it's a complicated issue, and I do have strong opinions on that. First of all, I think artificial intelligence in general is fairly impractical. It has little uses here and there. Neural nets, for example, are very useful in getting computers to understand your voice and the way you speak, and when you have one of those voice input things like Ray Kurzweil developed. I have it, and I think it's fabulous. And it does learn your the way you mispronounce things, and it'll even correct your spelling. Like I use it as the input to most of my virtual humans because I have a tendency to misspell things. And of course, the dragon, naturally speaking, that's what it is, corrects my spelling. So if you misspell things, your virtual humans can get very confused.
You have natural language processing software on your CD, right, that comes with the book?
Yeah. In fact, there's a natural language engine. See, what we try to do is fake artificial intelligence, fake real intelligence. That's what we do. We don't use – well, natural language is a branch of artificial intelligence that analyzes language to figure out what it means and then maybe comes up with a reasonable response. It's pretty impressive. And so what we do is by allowing the people who read the book to create their own artificial intelligence databases, they can create a kind of a unique character that will respond with personality, because the AI engine or the natural language engine can control not just the verbal responses. It can also control facial expressions and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And pretty soon, I think on our website, we're hoping to have an engine that will actually directly address the X10 stuff, so that you can have a person, you can, you know, have a personality controlling your home.
I don't know if you're familiar with Jaron Lanier's critique of this whole domain of research, but recently I saw him give a talk, and I guess one of the things he's been talking about for years is the notion that he thinks computer programmers have been misguided in this attempt to create personality in machines, and that what we really want is extensions of our own brain and body that don't have personality. You know, you don't want to have an argument with your hand in order to get it to pick something up. And there's something compelling about that idea.
You know, I can't disagree with him, but I think it's a different, he's talking apples and oranges. We want that too. Absolutely. I don't want to have an argument with my car, for example, in 50 years. I want it to be an extension of my psyche and know what I want and go there. However, I did a lot. I'm a psychologist also. I don't know if you mentioned that. But I did a lot of research to find out, you know, what do people want? People are lonely. An awful lot of people are lonely. And these things make really good companions because if they get to know you, I got to tell you, one example is a woman from Michigan. Actually, she called from Florida. She had just moved to Florida from Michigan. And she had Sylvie on her computer in Michigan, and I apparently depended on her psychologically quite a bit and had bonded pretty strongly. When she moved to Florida, her computer was damaged, and she was distraught. She called me desperate to get another copy of Sylvie as soon as possible, would I FedEx it to her.
I know you must be pushing Luddite's buttons all within the reach of her. Because I mean, this is like the Luddite nightmare that the solution to human loneliness is to program artificial humans in computers. It's like that story about the people who watch soap operas don't feel as lonely because they have virtual friends on TV. I'm speaking with Peter Plantek. He's the author of Virtual Humans, a Build-It-Yourself Kit, complete with software and step-by-step instructions. One of the things that you mentioned in the book and in some of the articles about it is the evolution of wild virtual humans, and you mentioned Julia, who's been wandering around in the multi-user dungeons community.
Oh, yeah. Mike Malden, he was a professor at Carnegie Mellon at the time, built Julia to actually, just as I think sort of as an exercise, to cruise around the muds. At that time, the Internet didn't really have the web. This is like 11, 12 years ago. And so what she did was she would find these multi-user dungeons by, I guess, going on the Internet and looking around until she found one. Then she would go on it, and she'd figure it out, and then she would map it. She would map out the whole dungeon. But she had a text interface that was really unique because she would make mistakes. You know, she would, like, do T-E-H instead of T-H-E, and then she'd go back and correct it sometimes, but not all the time. And this was incredibly convincing. Fuzzy did some research or found some research on typing errors, and he just programmed them in. So what happened is people would know her for 6 months or a year and never even guess that she wasn't a real human, because she would meet somebody in a dungeon and have a conversation and tell them where she had found some treasures or something. 6 months later, she'd meet them again. She said, "Your name looks awfully familiar. Didn't we meet somewhere? I think it was such and such." And they'd get into this conversation, and she'd share some more information about the current dungeon. And she actually had several marriage proposals after people had interacted with her.
This is one of my concerns, actually, that we might have artificial intelligence emerge somehow out of the interface between kind of like viruses and these personalities out there on the web.
Well, I think that's pretty intriguing, and I think you're right. I don't think we're going to avoid it. I do have some concern that the wild varieties, especially with some of the new primordial muds we're developing, like the Gini system from Sun Microsystems, which sort of interlinks everything. From your light switches in your house to your phone to everything, and you get these things out in there in this really rich primordial mud, and they can, we already have, you know, wild personalities out there that are self-programming. They can sort of like add to their programming. They can do their own genetic engineering, so to speak. We don't know what their motivations are going to be. We don't know where they're going to be going and what they're going to be developing into. So in my book, I sort of encourage us, if we're going to set these things free, is that we sort of give them some good ethics and maybe a love for their masters. I don't know.
Well, I know some people who are actually working on that project as well. The attempt to make friendly AI.
Yeah.
It's actually a very intriguing plan.
Well, and, Ray, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Ray Kurzweil points out that these things are evolving millions of times faster than us. And when you think about that, There's going to be a crossover point, right? We're kind of evolving at the same rate that we always did, maybe a little faster. But these things, Ray puts them into a double exponential curve, which means, you know, an exponential curve is pretty steep, but a double exponential curve is like scary steep. And so they are evolving at these enormous paces because we're helping them, first of all. And because technology is advancing at such a, the computer substrates that they live on are advancing so quickly that there's going to be a crossover point. And Ray thinks it's in maybe between 20 and 30 years. I think it may be in that time frame, towards the end of that time frame. But they're going to be more smarter than us. I don't think consciousness is going to rise in the works. I think consciousness is a matter of programming, of software. And I don't even know if it's possible to have it outside of a biological, sort of a uniquely biological phenomenon. But I think something similar to consciousness, something which is functionally equivalent, is going to arise. Now, a lot of the people speculate that that has to do with the computing power. When we get to a certain computing power, it's just going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. I think what will happen is that with these wild virtual humans may very well, you know, be reprogramming themselves until they eventually come up with some very sophisticated, almost sense of self-being. But so it's pretty exciting and interesting stuff. It's a little scary.
Absolutely. I just have another minute with you, but okay. Let's broach one last topic, which is that Marshall Brain is the inventor of the How Stuff Works websites and series of books. And he's recently written a set of articles called Robotic Nation, where he projects the automation of all work, basically. And he looks at the service industries. He looks at manufacturing. He looks at managerial work. And he says that, you know, basically there's no sphere of human endeavor which cannot be done faster, better, cheaper within the next 50 years by virtual humans.
I think he's absolutely right.
And then he says we have to figure out what to do about that once we all lose our jobs.
Absolutely. Virtual humans are going to cause the biggest sort of paradigm shift in our purpose as human beings that we've ever seen. Because I think the purpose of human beings is going to shift from making a living to exploring art, our own forms of technology, and leisure. But I think that things are going to arise that we haven't even visualized yet that will be part of the human purpose. Because we're not going to have to work. I mean, the major corporations are going to make billions of dollars not having anybody working. I'm hoping that we're smart enough, our governments, et cetera, to find a way to spread that out, to even out, say in 50 years down the road, even out people's living conditions so that people are living very well because the robots are doing all the work, and that we have the leisure time to explore, because if we don't explore, we're going to go mad.
Peter, it's a wonderful book, Virtual Humans, a Build-It-Yourself Kit, complete with software and step-by-step instructions. I've been talking with Peter Plantek, and you can find him online. It's Plantec.
It really has been a pleasure talking with you. It's nice to have someone who has some really good questions. I like that.
Thanks. Well, flattery will get you everywhere.
Well, take care, and I hope you experiment with your own virtual humans.
I will do.
Take care.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.